Welcome to the Relationship Recovery Podcast, hosted by Jessica Knight, a certified life coach who specializes in narcissistic and emotional abuse. This podcast is intended to help you identify manipulative and abusive behavior, set boundaries with yourself and others, and heal the relationship with yourself so you can learn to love in a healthy way.
Hello, and as always, thank you so much for being here. We're going to get pretty much right into the episode today. I have Courtney Gilmartin here. She is the founder of New Jersey Protective Moms, and it's an organization that helps moms in the family court system. As many of us know, the family court system is often misused by domestic abuse perpetrators and high conflict litigants, and this can be so damaging and be harmful. A lot of us spend so much time and money pulling out every hair that we have trying to protect our children while draining our financial resources. And New Jersey Protective Moms strives to provide solutions that address family court policies and procedures. They seek to reform advocacy, awareness, collaboration, and provide tons of education. They have an amazing resource list on their website that I will link in the show notes. Courtney takes us through the family court system. She talks about her family court battle. She also shares a lot of the current issues, the current policies, and we touch on the importance of strategy. So I absolutely recommend listening through to the end of this episode and, of course, going to njprotectivemoms.org to see more about the resources that they provide, because the resources listed on their site can help anybody in any state. As always, if you are looking to connect with me, you can reach out to me at jessica@jessicanightcoaching.com, at emotionalabusecoach.com, and you can find me on Instagram at emotionalabusecoach. Hi, Courtney. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Can you tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
Sure. So I am Courtney. As you said, I am a protective mother. I live in New Jersey. I have two children. They are sixth and eighth grade. And I am an advocate for family court reform. And I've been doing a lot of grassroots organization with other protective moms, advocacy and education around the challenges that protective moms face in family court.
How do you define what a protective mom is?
So a protective mom is really just a mother that, after leaving an abusive or toxic relationship, is going to do whatever she, you know, physically, financially, and emotionally can to safeguard her children from future harm. So it's definitely a struggle for mothers as they leave abusive relationships or marriages and they enter family court. I think a lot of people have this preconceived notion that family court is going to kind of wrap us in, you know, swaddling clothes and protect us and our children proactively. But that's definitely not the case in some instances. I would say probably in most instances. So a protective mom is really someone that is going to do that. You know, it's creating the safe space for their children. I know a lot of moms who are getting divorced get really frustrated with the parenting plans or the shared parenting and their ex's behavior and the impact on their children. And I see that. I feel that. I understand that. But I always stress to moms that you're still able to give your children that safe space, that home, that peace, even if it's 50% of the time or hopefully more, which is so important for children.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of moms, especially, you know, us that have gone through domestic violence, we've gone through neglectful parenting, we've seen their unhealthiness, like we really get hung up on the, you know, we can't be the parent we want to be in the 50% of time that we may get, but it's also, there's so much we still can do and to be mindful of. And we're still that stable parent in a lot of ways.
And I always say to, you know, look back. It's hard in the beginning, I think, because everything's so raw and you're trying to sort through just the fog and the emotions and the stress of a divorce or separation. And I always say to look back and think about the person you were when you were in that house, you know, 24/7 with your ex or soon to be ex. So you really can't be the person you want to be at all, right? So there's a sense of freedom, if you will, in that at least for 50% of the time, you can really be the mom or the parent that you want to be to your kids, because you don't have that person that you're always trying to appease or cater to, or be cognizant of how are they feeling, walking on eggshells. You know, a lot of our energy is spent trying to make them happy. At least in my case, it was. So when you don't live with that person anymore, that isn't, you know, the overarching environment in the home. You can really focus on yourself and the kids.
Yeah. I think that's such an important point that, like, you know, so much of your energy when you're still married or like when you're still so intertwined is like that there's, you are trying to make them happy and really trying to make them not abusive or less abusive a lot of the time, just like to appease, to keep it down, when the effect that that has on us, I don't know if you see this with some of the women you help. I certainly see it all the time of like, it's a lot of times I think we're unaware of like how much those eggshells are weighing on us.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an undercurrent of tension in the home, right? And kids are very receptive. They pick up on a lot of energy, so they can feel that. And it's really important to know that once you leave, you know, it's definitely not going to be easy, but at least at minimum, that feeling is gone. And there's something really nice about being able to relax and not have to appease that person or try to navigate them freaking out or blowing up or triggering them in any way. So I understand it's hard when the kids are not with you for the entire weekend, but I always say, like, your kids will be grateful when they come back to you and you're at peace or you're able to relax or have a nice dinner with them and you don't have that feeling, that impending doom of your ex coming home and just completely changing the rest of your day or your night.
Yeah. And, you know, I think like we can focus so much about how we see it and, you know, almost like expect or want the family court to see it the same way we see it. And there's obviously a lot we can do to help them see it, you know, and there's proper ways of documentation, there's strategy. But I think that Tina Swithin from One Mom's Battle talks about this a lot, is that the family court system is not trained on domestic violence or coercive control. They're not looking at things through the same lens that we are, even though we can see it like all over Instagram or all over the internet. Can you speak a little bit to that blind spot that the family court system has in relationship to domestic violence and coercive control?
Yeah. So I think for me, the biggest gap that I saw was that in the state of New Jersey, and I think this is true for a lot of states, they view being a domestic abuse victim as you have a final restraining order. Yeah. And most specifically in Jersey, it's really hard to get those final restraining orders. You know, the naysayers will say that it's very easy and people get them all the time, which is just not my experience. And I've talked to many other women who echo the same sentiment. So for me, no one was really viewing me as a domestic abuse victim because I didn't have that final restraining order. Yeah. But Jersey is lifetime restraining orders. They're very, very hard to get. And that being said, I first identified, okay, let me look at the statute of domestic abuse in New Jersey. What behaviors do they quantify it as? And then quickly realizing after I educated myself with the likes of like Evan Stark and Christine Cocciola and all of those emerging clinicians that are working in the coercive control space, that coercive control definitely needed to be added to the statute of domestic abuse in New Jersey in order for us to help a greater, you know, cast a wider net in New Jersey for people that are going through abusive relationships and entering family court. So that's kind of how New Jersey Protective Moms and my advocacy work naturally started, because I was reaching out to senators and I have a friend that does lobbying in New Jersey and just asking her, you know, where's best to start. And I met other moms throughout my journey, both, you know, the power of social media, it's good and bad, through social media and in person at various events in Jersey. And we decided and we felt that we would have like a much better response from lawmakers, legislators, senators, and people in the system that could help us if we created a nonprofit and kind of banded together and really organized ourselves in a better way. So it's totally grassroots. I mean, we started New Jersey Protective Moms. We did some research, you know, we built out a website. We started using that as a means to reach out to the senators expressing our interest in getting coercive control passed. And then we ultimately ended up testifying in favor of the bill. And after a pretty long road, it got signed into law January 8th of this year by the senator. So now it is an act of domestic abuse in New Jersey, which is great because, you know, our second kind of law that we want to see get passed here is a version of Kaden's law. We wanted to make sure that we had a broader group of people that could be helped that were domestic abuse victims, which is why we wanted that coercive control added to the definition of domestic abuse in New Jersey before we started down the custody path.
Can you speak a little bit about what Kaden's law is? That's not something we've covered on this podcast so far, but I think it's really important. And I'm in Massachusetts. So, you know, and the states that that Kaden's law, you know, has passed, and I believe most of them were more West Coast. So having it come more East is super important.
Yeah, I think Pennsylvania is almost there, which will be important, like you said, because a lot of states too, it's almost like copycat. And this is what I tell people that reach out to me.
Yeah.
The more states that have coercive control or a version of Kaden's law, the better, because senators and legislators in other states are more apt to do it because it's almost like monkey see, monkey do. So which protective parents and anyone in this space should use to their advantage. So Kaden's law is named after a young girl from Pennsylvania. So I always say shame on Pennsylvania for waiting this long to pass it, but I'm glad it was there. Yeah. And it was passed nationally, I want to say 21 or so. So now we have to adopt it on the state level because child custody is really, it's deferred to the states. So I want to say Florida has Grayson's Law, which is somewhat similar in scope, but not Kaden's Law. Kaden's Law will secure federal funding for states. There's some clauses in there about judicial training on domestic abuse and warning signs and how child custody cases should be handled when there is domestic abuse. And it just gives much clearer guidelines to the family court in regards to how they should structure parenting access, parental access and parenting time when there's domestic violence in the case. So it's something we definitely need. You know, in a lot of the state custody statutes, you know, there's factors that judges should consider when awarding custody. And of course, abuse and domestic violence is in there, but it's almost like a gray area of how it's weighed in correlation to the other factors. So this is just much more prescriptive. It's much more clear. And it's something that we definitely need. You know, there's a lot of pushback from it. From what I hear, there's a lot of pushback because the judicial branches don't want to be told what they should be doing from the legislative branches. But I think some states have successfully, you know, worked through that with the legislator. They've made amendments or whatnot if they have to, but that's kind of getting into the weeds. But I know that we in New Jersey definitely want to see it pass. And we unfortunately had a young boy that was killed by his father during unsupervised parenting time, despite concerns of abusive behavior, which obviously came true. So I'm hoping that New Jersey will pass it in this legislative session. Excuse me. It's always a tongue twister.
It is. It is. Yeah. Well, all these big, long words describe, you know, but yeah, like you just touched on, I mean, obviously a lot of very important things, but there's one thing you noted that like the judicial branch doesn't want to be told what to do by the legislative branch. And there's one of the more fascinating things I learned, and this was in the last 2 years or so, is that our hairstylists, the people on, you know, barbers, they have probably more DV training than people on the bench or judges on the bench. And I was like, I found that like fascinating because there is no requirement. And also fascinating that people can be a judge in the family court system without even practicing family law before. And it almost painted this like picture of like how blind at times they could be to some of the issues that are presented in front of them and almost like assume goodwill of those that are really putting a lot of children in danger.
I know. And I know that's a struggle. And I had a judge on my case for 3 years consecutively, which I feel like I hit the lotto because that's a long time, you know, all things considering in family court. And it's almost like in medical school, they do rounds. It's kind of how the judges do it. You know, they rotate through and then they kind of settle in into the area of expertise they want to settle in. And I think family court is It's very emotionally powered, if you will. There's a lot of emotion in it. It's not, you know, black and white. It's not really driven by law. It's driven by law and emotion. And I think that makes it really, really taxing on a lot of people. And I think, you know, protective moms are in it and it's stressful and it's awful. But I think there's also definitely some bleed over on the professionals. There has to be, you know, mm-hmm. So it's difficult because I think the really good judges probably don't stay in family court, which is unfortunate. I have a new judge now in my case that I haven't met yet, but if we have to go back, you know, we'll be in front of him. And I have some hope there because he's a former district attorney. But again, you don't know, which is kind of also, it's a scary thing for a lot of people, you know? Mm-hmm. So that also makes it challenging. I think I was listening to a podcast recently with Joan Meyer, and she was saying how the laws for restraining orders are pretty good. And some of the laws pertaining to custody are pretty good. Of course, we need Kaden's law in every state. But it's the interpretation that's really, really bad in family court.
That's where
I see like a huge problem. So I'm hoping that better training will help fill that gap. But honestly, and it's something New Jersey Protective Moms wants to really work on, is the training component. There has to be survivors in there talking to these judges and lawyers and really sharing their story. And I think that's something I'm hoping that the organizations that run these trainings can really start leaning into, because I think those survivor stories are really impactful and they need to hear real life examples to really have an impact, I think, on them, to make them change their viewpoint from the bench. And I think for me, I see a really big problem with the family law attorneys. I mean, in being that family law matters are so emotionally driven, it's almost as if they capitalize on that, because mm-hmm. when they go into family court or even just the correspondence and the letters and the things that are said, they're so inflammatory that it's almost like dumping gasoline on the fire, right? It just continues the conflict. And for me, I've seen just completely unethical behavior. I mean, I'm shocked in the courtroom with some of the stuff that goes on. So I think there also needs to be some accountability for the lawyers, because they're really driving this conflict, a lot of them, you know. And I say to a lot of protective moms, I'm like, the lawyer's strategy is 100% billable hours.
Yeah.
So you need a strategy. And I think that's also a huge gap. You know, there's a gap within the system, and we need to, you know, that's going to take years, and we need laws to bring them up to speed, because I hear, I'm kind of going off on a tangent, so forgive me, but I hear a lot of naysayers saying the laws aren't going to change anything. The laws aren't going to help. And my response to them is always, if we don't have the laws, we have nothing.
You know, right.
Family court is a court of law. So they're guided by the principles of the law. So we need the laws to come up to current research. Coercive control, we know, is the foundation of all domestic abuse. That absolutely should be recognized as domestic abuse in all 50 states without question. Of course, I think it should be a crime, but I don't know if we'll ever see that here. Mm-hmm. It's a crime in other countries. And so we need the laws first and foremost. And then we need educated litigants. And you and I talked about this briefly before we started, but you really have to do your research and due diligence, because if you have a law that can be used in your case, you can talk with your lawyer about it and strategize how to bring that in.
Yeah.
But if there was no law, there's nothing for you to latch on to.
And if you don't know it, yeah.
An emotion's not going to win in family court. It can't, right?
Yeah.
They have to, you know, follow the law, which is a hard pill for people to swallow, and get it. But I tell everyone, you have to do your due diligence, research case law. You know, you can just put anything into Google. You know, we live in a really privileged era, and it's only going to continue to get better, where we have so many resources available to us for free. Mm-hmm. You just have to take the time to really educate yourself and connect with other people that you can trust that might not have all of the answers, but can give you something that you can, you know, use, or you can continue on your own journey to educate yourself.
And that at least points you in the right direction,
right.
You know,
right.
And I know on your website, you have a lot of resources, and I'll post your link in the show notes so people can just go easily click it. But I don't have it in front of me right now, but I believe there was like 15 resources on your resource page that were, you know, resources that you can like that you can use, that you can read, that you can think about. There's Instagram profiles that are actually really good, like Custody Peace, One Mom's Battle. Yeah.
Me Too Family too, I think. Me Too,
yeah. Yeah, there's a family court one I'm thinking of too. And I'll post those as well, just so if somebody wants to see them. But it's like a lot of times, like, you know, we don't want to spend our time on, you know, piecing together who's a narcissist on Instagram. But in this case, I feel like it's a way to begin to, an easy way and even a safe way for those that have our digital spaces monitored to be able to look at, okay, like, what are some things that I can begin to think about? And then I can go research and then I can go look at it, you know, and then I can like think about how can I use this as a strategy in my case? Because, you know, as I help people heal from emotionally abusive relationships, and I also work in high conflict divorce cases. And a lot of time, my work is on strategy and understanding different methods and really some of the emotional piece, because like you said, like a lawyer's strategy is billable hours, but they don't want our emotions either, you know? Right. And I made that mistake years and years ago of thinking that my lawyer was supposed to care about my feelings, and she didn't. And she, but she also didn't see what I was seeing and was trying to like get this to the settle, like almost like to her credit, she did what she was, she did her job, right? Like at the end of the day, the court system is overcrowded. They don't want more cases. She didn't see this going to trial and she got it to the end and in a way. But at the same time, there's a lot of blind spots that were there because I didn't have a proper strategy and we weren't talking about strategy. It was more so like as the issues came up.
Yes.
And that makes it feel like you're running a bunch of like 1 mile races and not a marathon. When
yeah, I think I'm,
yeah, it's a marathon.
Yeah, I come across that all the time. You know, I talk to women a lot and I always say, you know, what's your strategy? And they're like, well, I haven't talked to my lawyer about strategy yet. And it's exactly what you said. It's so reactive. It's not proactive at all. Something happens, then everyone's scrambling and the lawyers, I feel like first knee-jerk reaction is always, well, we can file a motion. A motion practice is so expensive. I mean, you're looking at, depending on your lawyer's hourly rate, you're looking at between 5,000 to 10,000, I would say on average for a motion. And, you know, if you have a divorce and you have 3-4 motions, you're already looking at $50,000 before anything else goes on just for those motions. So it's important to have a strategy of your own and use your lawyer almost as a strategic partner. Like, this is what I really want and need. How can we get there? What are my options right now at this stage of my divorce? Yeah. And you know, your lawyer is almost like a mirror of you. If you go in there and you're super emotional, which I know it's so hard to do, and I don't want people to think that I'm diminishing the experience because I understand it's super emotional, it's painful, but try to save the emotional unloading for your therapist or your coach and try to just go into your lawyer with bullet points and a strategy. Because to your point, I don't know if they really don't want to hear it, because I do. Mm-hmm. I do want to hope that they have some empathy for people, but
I think it depends on who they are, to be
exactly
honest.
And it's also just they're busy, they're overloaded too. So, and the emotion, like I said, that's not going to win an argument for them. They have to find what law or what statute they can latch onto to win for you. So that's how strategy comes into play. So go to your lawyer, and if you're, you know, not emotional and you're just like, this is what I want, this is what I need, how can we get there? I think you'll get a much better response from them.
Yeah.
You'll be more efficient. You know, you'll be able to strategize better. They deal with reasonable and unreasonable people all day, these lawyers. And, you know, I've been in family court litigation now for 7 years. So I've talked to my lawyer about this extensively. And she's always like, well, it's nice to be able to talk to you because you're reasonable. So I can explain things to you and then we can kind of make a plan. So, and trust me, there are days when I want to scream and not be reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, there's many days I don't want to be reasonable, but yeah.
You know, you have to. Efficiency is key. And I think people get hung up a lot on fighting for things that in the end don't really matter.
Yeah.
And I always say, like, you need to get in and out of a divorce unscathed as possible, because dragging it on is only going to continue to fill your lawyer's bank account. And you need to make sure that you have a really good MSA that's thorough And the key piece that I see a lot of people missing is you need enforcement clauses if someone doesn't abide by the agreement. Unfortunately, the sad truth is if you're dealing with a high conflict person or a narcissistic abusive person, you're probably going to be in some sort of post-settlement, you know, litigation, whether it's with a mediator or PC or back in court. You know, I hope, knock wood, that everyone listening is not, but unfortunately, it's probably the case, especially if they don't comply. So you need that enforcement piece in there so that you can leverage it. Because, and again, I think this is also a fundamental gap. People don't understand the divorce process. And why would they if they're, you know, a lay person and they're not in family court? But there's no, you know, like enforcement police after you get divorced. Yeah. You know, people are always like, well, doesn't he have to do that? I'm like, well, says who? Like, who's coming to enforce this? You know, you have to go back to court.
And they know that. And the narcissist kind of knows that, right? Like, or the high conflict parent, co-parent. Yeah. I have a client right now that there's clauses around what he's supposed to pay for. Her partner, her ex-partner is supposed to be like, so extracurriculars, obviously, like summer's coming up, camp, things like that. You know, he just doesn't pay because there's nothing to enforce it. And then she goes to her lawyer and the lawyer's like, well, you can file a contempt. And it's like, well, now I have to pay to get paid. Right. And then it's like, well, what amount of money do I go in for? Is it worth, should I do it now? Should I wait until after? Like all these questions, when I'm sitting on the other side, all I'm hearing is like the dollar signs of this legal bill that's going to far surpass what she's owed in the first place. I mean, I guess the benefit of working with like a coach or you know, someplace that has like resources around this is that I feel like you and I would both say to this person, like, you can go to court, but you need to get wording in there that clarifies what this means so that you don't have to keep going back.
Right.
Like, let's get that enforcement in there.
Right.
You're not just going in on a contempt. We're going in on a modification. Yeah.
Right. And then this is what I always say to people too. Judges love MSAs or consent orders because in their mind, they can enforce that easier. They don't really have to do a lot of work, right? You already agreed to something. So that's why if you can get enforcement in your MSA, that makes it so much easier for the judge to grant your request because he's going to look at you both and say you agreed to this. Because a marriage settlement agreement or global settlement agreement, whatever you call it in whatever state you're listening in, is essentially a giant consent order. And I say that in like the terms from how the court looks at it, because I know that it's almost like coerced consent. You know, like at the end of the day, is anyone really happy with their MSA? No. And there's things you have to give up to get them there, right? It's like a giant game of chess, but the court views it as a giant consent order. So they're thinking, well, you guys both agreed to this. So therefore, we're just going to enforce what's in there. And that's what was helpful for me in my journey with the settlement custody piece is my lawyer had the foresight to put in a clause in our custody section of our MSA that we were both unhappy with the custody arrangement. He wanted 50-50. I wanted him to have way less time than he had, which was less than 50-50, thankfully. And that we both agreed that we could request a custody evaluation without a change in circumstance. And we named our expert that we ended up ultimately using in the divorce decree. So when things really peaked and got really bad and I knew we needed the custody evaluation, it was very easy for the judge to grant that with the expert that I knew that we needed for our family dynamic and what was going on because it was in our MSA.
Yeah.
So I knew, you know, a custody evaluation is extremely stressful. And I always say to people, do not throw it around. It's not like something to take lightly. I knew at least I was going to be getting an expert that was qualified enough to handle what was happening in my family.
Yeah. And for those listening that are wondering like what an MSA is or a GSA, it's in Massachusetts and in some of the surrounding states, it's like, it's your parenting plan. So here it's called a separation agreement. And so there's like a financial side and then there's the side that's focused on the children. And that's obviously the only one that can be opened and like the finances around the children, at least here in the state. But like the detail that goes into that and in subsequent modifications is so important. And that's something that I learned over time is that, you know, lawyers may want to broad stroke things to leave room for interpretation, but that doesn't help you.
I know.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the most important thing, and now I'm really seeing a bad trend where I'm seeing women who are in divorce proceedings for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and they don't even have a draft MSA at all. They haven't even started it. So, you know, their lawyer's kind of pushing them down the road of forensic accountants and custody experts and all these different service providers or third parties, if you will. I mean, I've seen a lot of people with parenting coordinators, PCs involved in their case before they're even divorced. And I'm like, that is just bananas. You're spending now money on two lawyers. You have a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, my strategy and what I always tell people is you need to start a draft MSA right away, a working document where you can start fleshing out the details with your lawyer. Because at any point in time, and I think this is also something lawyers don't stress to women going through this or protective moms, you don't need to go to mediation. You don't need to go to arbitration. Mm-hmm. You don't need to have a trial. You can settle. You're not going to want to probably. But you know, if you get to the courthouse steps and they want to settle, which happens more times than not, and you have no like foundational document and you're scrambling, that's where things really get missed or sloppy. So you want to have a working document. That's something, you know, you can create on your own. You can create a Word doc. You can find MSA drafts. You can talk to parents or, you know, resources like you who have been divorced. Like, what are the big areas I need to incorporate? And then start fleshing out the more minute details with your attorney. Obviously, get legal advice before you do this. But, you know, you can start working through that for sure.
Yeah. And it will save you a lot of money to troubleshoot some of that and think about it and think about the wording and the issues.
Yeah.
And figure out which hill you're willing to die on, which ones you're not. And it can help so much because, you know, like when you were talking before, I just was like note taking like crazy over here. But one of the things you said is like the lawyer strategy is billable hours, right? Mm-hmm. So, but that's not your strategy. And you're going to have, for most of us, it's not one and done, right? So we do need to keep some in the reserve for other things that will happen, you know, and being able to get ahead of it can help so much. And also you'll learn so much. You'll be so much more prepared, more grounded. It doesn't necessarily take away the emotional side of it, but it does help you feel, I think, a little bit more in control. Not that you can control the outcome, but like more in control of yourself as you go through the process.
Yeah. And you can be in the middle of divorce proceedings and have motions filed, and then you're at the mercy of a judge who's going to throw out temporary orders where the temporary orders could end up sticking, or there's a risk that they could end up sticking. And then your ex's lawyer is going to argue that it should stick, especially if it's something like temporary 50-50 custody or something. So you want to avoid that if you can, as much as possible. You kind of want to be steering the ship and just really like get to settle, put the things in the MSA, like you said, the hills you want to die on, but get them in there and get them to agree. And I, you know, obviously this is case specific and this is not legal advice. I just want to preface, but you know, I tell a lot of moms now that I talk to, try to get a clause in there that you reserve the right to a best interest eval. I always say, don't do a best interest eval when you're in the middle of a divorce. It's so emotionally driven. They're really likely to just, you know, lob a 50-50 recommendation and say, you know, the parents are fighting, because statistically, 97% of divorcing couples, the conflict will dissipate within the first 2 years post, you know, settlement. And that's like statistics. I forget where that's from. I'd have to look it up to source it. That's something that's burned in my head. So time is our worst enemy and our best friend, because the longer it goes on, you know, obviously the more your children are exposed to potentially neglectful, dangerous, abusive behaviors. But you really want to be able to get to a point where you can be like, I'm not just a statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Something is wrong here and I need third party intervention. For me, you know, I waited 5 years post settlement to have a custody evaluation, which most people would probably think I'm crazy for doing that. But now looking back in hindsight, I think if I did it while we were getting divorced, A, it would have dragged out my divorce and been so much more expensive. And B, I think we would have had 50-50 and I would have been hard pressed to get the change that I got, which now I have primary custody. I have, you know, sole decision making for everything. And my daughter does not have to go see him at all anymore, which has been an amazing relief for everybody. And my son has very, very limited time with him. So I don't think that would have happened at all if we were in the middle of a divorce, because so many of those other factors would have clouded what was really going on. And I wouldn't have had the amount of substantial evidence that I had if I had gone earlier than I had.
Yeah, which also just speaks to like you being able to really focus on and get in tune to the best interests of your children and to right. Like work from that place. Like in that, when you were talking earlier, that's something I wrote down too, is that like the courts, they go based on the best interests of children, but that is so easily arguable, especially at the beginning. But once there's time and evidence
right.
And a plan that's not working and right. Parts of plans that are working, like it holds a lot more weight. And, you know, I think often we all, I mean, I've certainly done this. I panic, you know, when I'm like, oh my God, my child's going to hate this. This is, you know, it's like, there are things I can do. You know, there's ways that we can document. Let's see how things go. Like, let's have an informed argument when we go back there that shows the court what's going on rather than like, because I said so, because they hear that all day.
I know.
You know, and they hear that from the other side too.
I know. And that's something I also say to protective moms. I'm like, if you have a abuse allegation or you have valid, you know, abuse concerns, because I hate the word allegation because it makes it seem like it's not true. So I don't want to seem like I'm dismissing abuse allegation, abusive behavior, because I'm not. If you say something or you raise a concern to the court, you're going to have enough evidence to prove that, right? To your point, you can't just say, well, because I said so, or because he yelled once, because that's not going to hold weight to the court. So sometimes it takes a long time to get that evidence, and patience really is a virtue in these cases. But, and it almost sounds counterintuitive, but you have to kind of prove what doesn't work to get to a point where you can get an order that's going to safeguard you from that stuff. So for example, we've used two PCs. My ex has fired them both and tried to physically fist fight one of them. So obviously that wasn't going to continue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you know, both PCs wrote letters to the court saying, you know, like, he's aggressive, he doesn't listen, he doesn't take any of the recommendations, he just doesn't follow anything, he's very difficult to work with. So now I have very explicit orders from the court that PCs are not to be used in our case, and we are never to use a third party again, which saves me time and money now. And that's why I also have sole decision making, because even if we have a third party, it doesn't reduce the conflict, right? So that to me is a huge win, because I don't want to be locked in with a PC for the rest of my kids' lives. It's a nightmare, and nothing changes. We know that. But I had to endure, unfortunately, years of trying to make it work. But now I have a very explicit court order that I will never have to use a PC or a co-parenting therapist again with him, which is like a giant win for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you mentioned like the third parties, and I'm wondering, who have you had in your case? Like, have you had a GAL? Have you had a, you know, I don't know, parenting coordinator? Call it the a la carte of the family court system when they don't know what to do. They're like, oh, how about one of these? And we'll have one of those. I hate it, but it's a reality, right? So
I know. And that's what I also tell, you know, protective moms. I'm like, you're not going to want to hear this, but this is the reality. So you have to have some sense, some sort of radical acceptance. That doesn't mean it's okay. That doesn't mean it's not BS. I don't want to curse. It doesn't mean it's not frustrating and aggravating and a waste of time and money, but it is what it is. So there's a strategy in dealing with all the different experts. So in my case, I've had two PCs. We had one in our MSA appointed, and then when things got really bad in the summer of 2021 and we went back into court, and that's when we got the custody evaluator ordered, a new PC, and a co-parenting therapist ordered. So I've had all of those. We had two rounds of mediation. We ended up settling before trial. And then we have a GAL now, but the GAL is more in a family role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it was recommended by our custody evaluation, but it's really just more so to oversee, you know, progress in various therapies that my ex has to do. And it's not making legal decisions for the kids, because I still have that sole decision-making power and authority. So I don't have, you know, experience with the traditional GAL. I've heard good and bad. I think there's bad professionals, unfortunately, like scattered throughout family court. So that's why it's also very important to work with a coach or someone that's going to help you manage your emotions when you're dealing with third parties, because you really need to take a hard and fast look at who you're dealing with and approach them with caution and in a way that's going to work for your case and the end result you want. I also have had, unfortunately, the pleasure of working with a reunification therapist after it was last year. Yeah. And thankfully it wasn't like an intensive reunification therapist. It was a one-off for, you know, a weekly visit, but it was still definitely not a great experience. And she was not equipped to handle my ex at all. The manipulation and the concerning behaviors that I had been calling out for many years continued even when she was in the room with my daughter and him. So she definitely wasn't equipped to handle him. But again, I've now gotten to a point where I have a very clear order where we know reunification doesn't work at this moment. It's not something that was recommended right now. There are things that need to be done successfully by my ex before we're going to start even considering reunification at this point. So that again is also a huge win because, you know, I knew that it was going to be tough and it was not easy, but I got my daughter there when she needed to be there and I talked her through it and I got her a therapist that really understood. And, you know, she's 14. So we did some EMDR with her to try to work through some of the things that were really challenging for her. And that helped, but it still wasn't easy. But now, you know, we have a very clear order that it's not indicated right now. It's not in the best interest for her. And, you know, maybe sometime down the road, you know, we can revisit it, but it will be with someone who will be much better equipped to deal with any of the behaviors that are problematic.
Yeah. And I think like your daughter is older, your daughter's double the age of mine. It's like my daughter certainly has a voice, but like your daughter, you know, has a stronger one. She has more history. It's like also somebody that's going to listen to her on the other side too, is I'm sure is so important rather than like telling the kid what they think is best for them rather than letting the kid speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. And that's why time was also so important in my case. And again, people listening, I know it seems impossible and it seems hard, but if I look back to where I am now 5 years ago, I would have never thought I was here. So it can happen. It takes a tremendous amount of resources and, you know, you're going to go through a variety of emotions, but you can do it. Just take one day at a time, literally one step at a time. But when we got separated, my children were young, they were 5 and 3. And then when we got divorced, they were a little bit older, but obviously so much time has passed, you know, we're past the 7 year mark now. So when my kids were little, 5, 6, 7 years old, they can't really express as much as they can now as 14 and you know, 11 years old. You know, my daughter's going to be in high school. My daughter, she did ultimately end up getting interviewed by the judge in the fall, which was huge for her. She really needed that. She wrote a whole letter. She went on the record. It was really therapeutic for her. She was able to really express herself to the judge. And I think it helped give the judge, obviously, some more context. But most importantly, it didn't really change anything in terms of the case, like groundbreaking, but it gave my daughter a sense of closure and healing that she needed. So everyone involved in the case really wanted to get that for her, which was important. So we made that happen and I'm happy that she was able to do that. So, but my point is like, I also needed that time to pass so that they could really go to the evaluator and give her their lived experience and tell her how they're feeling and it not come from me because the evaluator is there to evaluate what's best for the kids. So she really needs to be able to have the insight from them on how the behaviors or what's going on or the schedule or anything that's a problem in your family impacts them from their point of view. And sadly, you know, they really can't portray that in a way that's impactful until they're probably, you know, like 5th, 6th, 7th grade, maybe 4th for some. But I think if you can wait till that 5th, 6th, 7th grade, it's definitely probably going to be better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's so clear when you talk that you've really been through so much in the family court system and also have seen so much in those that you've helped and that you've supported. I know people are going to listen to this and really want to connect with you and also connect with what you do. Can you share a little bit before we end on your organization and how people can find you and connect to you?
Yeah, sure. So we are New Jersey Protective Moms. We have newjerseyprotectivemoms.org. There's a contact us field on our website where you can send your information over and it goes right to my inbox. So I do try to get back to everyone within a few days. And I'm public on Instagram and Facebook. So Courtney Gilmartin on both. And like you said, you know, I try to put as much resources and current resources out on my website to try to help women, because I don't want it to be behind a paywall. I want everyone to be able to go there and do some research for themselves.
Yeah.
I list, you know, clinicians and professionals and podcasts and some, you know, research literature on there and good case studies that you can use that hopefully are helpful. So happy to, you know, help if I can or point people in the right direction. Like you said, our organization is really focused on awareness and education and advocacy right now. We're hoping that we can get that version of Kaden's Law passed soon. And we want to start fundraising one day, but that's like our 2-year plan. Hopefully we can have a fund one day for moms that are going through custody litigation and help provide them some financial help to get a lawyer that will help secure the safety of their children. But that's our, you know, high arching goal. So more to come.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot more to come. Well, I'm so glad that we were able to connect and this was so informative. You know, before we got on, we both sort of said like, we know what we're going to talk about, but we were certain it was just going to flow. And it absolutely did, because I think you and I have just been in this world for a long time and also have helped a lot of people as much as we can. And I think you made this point without saying it, like it's always changing, always evolving. And like there's policies, there's laws, there's so much to do in so many directions it can go, but it is always evolving and changing. And it's important to keep your finger on the pulse.
Yep. I agree.
Well, thank you so much. And I do hope to have you back in the future. I'd love to speak with you again.
Yeah, I'd love that. Thank you.